We really need to be able to find a tremendous amount of renewing in our time together. We need to be able to look at and to value the time that we have to spend praying together, singing together, and being built up together. And I hope that you get as much out of that as I do. I've often said, especially for our midweek service, there are times where I'm amazed I drug myself to the building because it just had been a long week that far. But then, oh, you're fine, honey.
Okay.
Can't go there without your sword. Huh? Okay. Very good. You're welcome. But yet, after you take a little bit of time, you shake some hands, you share some smiles, you share in the day, you share in some singing, you have some Bible reading and some application, you have an invitation offered, you do some more singing. All those things take strength, right? They take energy. You're already tired, but at the end of that midweek service, I, thankfully, walk out of there with more energy than I walked in. And I'm just grateful that this group has considered this Family Bible Week and the emphasis that it puts on us as a group, but especially in the family, and that work that will renew us and strengthen us and help us to be better equipped to guide our families, to be a light in the community, and ultimately bear fruit for our own sake, our own soul's growth. Tonight we're going to talk about this second individual here that we're going to find his story in John chapter 6, as we mentioned. And we will have a much different format tonight. I feel badly that I kind of gave you all the drink from the fire hose last night. I unloaded a lot of material and did it in a very quick fashion. That's all fine and good, but sometimes it doesn't give us time to think about, to chew about what's being said and how that really affects me. What does that really mean for me? How, when I leave the doors, can I agree that I have been changed by what's been revealed? And I think sometimes we might be guilty of trying to go through things a little too quickly just for the sake of getting them done, and then we don't really glean from it the things that we should. So tonight, we're going to look at this. I'd like you to turn to John chapter 6, if you would, please. We're gonna read this in its entirety here. It's 13 verses. It shouldn't take us very long. But it'll help us set the stage for what we're talking about and that we can appreciate the young man that we're going to look at tonight. So we start out with the first few verses here, John chapter 6, and it says, "After these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. Then a great multitude followed him because they saw his signs which he performed on those who were diseased. And Jesus went up to the mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. Now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. Verse 5, then Jesus lifted up his eyes, and seeing a great multitude coming toward him, he said to Philip, 'Where shall we buy bread that these may eat?' But this he said to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them. That every one of them may have a little.' One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, let me get to this next slide if you're using the slides. This is tricky, it's behind you. There is a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, 2 small fish. Well, what are they among so many?' Then Jesus said, 'Make the people sit down.' Now there was much grass in the place. So the men sat down in number about 5,000. And Jesus took the loaves when he had given thanks. He distributed them to the disciples and the disciples to those sitting down, and likewise of the fish, as much as they wanted. So when they were filled, he said to his disciples, 'Gather up the fragments that remain so that nothing is lost.' Therefore, when they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves, which were left over by those who had eaten." And that's the summary of the scriptures that we're going to be referencing. And it is so difficult to stay on track with this section of verses because there are so many things that you could look at and you could teach about this narrative here. And it's something that we hope that, you know, we can glean from tonight and we make application with. But yet, one of the most, I think, overlooked details in this narrative is this young man, this young lad that because of his willingness, because of his giving spirit, was able to participate in one of the most well-known miracles that Jesus performed. And so tonight as we go through these slides, I have some questions I'm going to ask you all. Now, I'm not going to point at you, and I don't know most of your names, but I'm going to ask them as a general question, and I would love for you all to participate and give me your feedback and let me know what you're thinking. Let me know what's in your mind, okay? Now, when you taught your children to share, it didn't happen automatically, did it? You need to share your toys with someone. Yeah, that took a lot of teaching, didn't it? And even more so at a meal. You know, I have four daughters, and they do well now because they're older, but when they were younger, they were pretty possessive of their food. They didn't really care to share a whole lot. And it's not like they ever were starving. There was always enough to go around. But what's mine is mine. And we kind of have that mentality until we're taught to share. But yet, because of this young man and his willingness to share, look at the ability that he has now for himself recorded forever in the history of the Scriptures, his participation, his assistance with this miracle that Jesus wrought. I want to just look at a few things about this young man, okay? He had the mind to be there in the first place, right? You know, you think about our young people, and you think about one of the things that worries us. I don't like to throw a lot of statistics out at people, although the few that we shared last night I felt were necessary to establish the premise that we were talking about with our teens. But yet, it's no secret that the church as a whole in this country is dwindling. Its memberships are slowly, gradually tapering off. More and more of our young people are seeing less and less of a need to attend regular services. I put a lesson together some years ago, and I called it spiritual Snicker bars, because the idea behind it was when you get a little hungry and you don't have time for a meal, you might be inclined to eat a Snicker bar because is it the one that truly satisfies you, or whatever the tagline was. So you eat that little Snicker bar and then you can go another couple hours, right? Because it gave you a little bit of nutrition. Well, social media provides an excellent platform for spiritual Snicker bars. You know, you've got a buddy or a friend or a colleague that shares some Bible verses, and you read those Bible verses, and you may be kind of reflective about those things, or you'll read a heartwarming story, or you'll have someone share some scripture, or maybe you have a lot of people on your feed and in your friend group and whatever it is you call it that, you know, are spiritually minded. So, you know, you kind of spend some time throughout the week and all that, and that's all good until it starts to take the place of come and properly worshiping the Lord. And so what happens is children are not the only ones that are affected by this. We have to be on guard as adults, especially for our own souls, but the example that we set, that'll be a theme throughout all three nights for our adults, is the examples that we're setting for our young, that we teach them by example the need and necessity to make time for these important things. And this man here, this young man, he had already learned to be present, to desire that thing. And for what motives, we don't know. We can't presume to know why he was there, but he was there. And one of the things that he had also done is he was prepared, wasn't he? You know, I can tell you that I've made a lot of decisions in my life based on my stomach. And this guy must have known, hey, there might be a chance that I might be out there a while. And it almost kind of reminds me of the parable of the 10 virgins, right? So some preparation that was taken to ensure that I might endure in the wilderness. I don't know where we are or how far they are from the closest small towns, but we get the feeling, we get the idea from the context that they're at some distance, right? Because they're going to go by. They got to go get the stuff. But yet also, he was there. He had provision with him, but that he did, of course, have that willingness to share that which he brought. Now, we don't know how old this young man was, But it seems to me, based on the fact that he was there in the crowd and the fact that he brought provisions, tells me that he was likely old enough to realize that what he brought wasn't going to feed everybody. And that that young man was willing to give up what he had with the realization he may not get any. And that's something kind of profound for an adult. I'm going to give of what I have, and there's an opportunity I won't get any of it, even though I brought it, possibly for me. We don't normally think that that's something we would decide unless we'd been guided by the Scriptures to know, to want to share. But yet he did. And of course, as we see, and what's so interesting, and one of the many, many points here, the fragments that they took up were many times more than what they started with, which I think is wonderful. So I ask you the question, how does the mindset of this young man measure up to our thinking? He had an opportunity, very possible an opportunity that he had never had before. But he had made preparation, he had made purpose to be there when Jesus was there. Now, we have to fight the mindset of routine. Because when something's always in front of us, we have a tendency to take it for granted. But I know I'm not the only person that when I've sat at the feet of someone teaching or preaching or have participated in some songs and prayers about something that I have heard many, many times before, here's something new. See it in a little bit of a different light. You know, one of the most amazing things of why the gospel is as dynamic as it is, why it speaks to us all the time, is because the gospel we're taught is forever the same, isn't it? Well, how is it then that we can learn things new all the time from it? What's changing in that equation? The gospel? What's changing? We are, right? Our perspective is changing. Our understanding is changing. Because life, God designed life to be a great teacher. Sometime by gentle guidance, right? Sometimes by a 2x4 across the side of the head. But life teaches us every day a lot of things. And when we're disciplined enough to get our mind and get our heart back in front of the Lord on a regular basis, is when we have the greatest opportunity to grow, to apply the knowledge that we have. Knowledge in itself isn't as valuable as wisdom, because I've learned to apply the knowledge that I've gained. This young man desired to be in the presence of that teaching. This young man had that disposition. How does that parallel to mine? How does that parallel to yours? Many of you likely drove in an air-conditioned vehicle. Get to sit in an air-conditioned building on a padded seat with clean clothes, unless you come from work. And if you did, appreciate you being here. Been there many times. But yet look at the measure of comfort that we're enjoying. But how many times have we been tempted in times past to say, I'm just too busy. You know, I recognize that there are a lot of places y'all could be tonight. And you know, my heart goes out for the people that decided against coming tonight. Y'all, I understand, did a wonderful job reaching out to the community and trying to get the word out of what you were doing. I'm very grateful that you did that, and that I hope that that seed is sown and that growth comes because of that. But look at that decision that has to take place. It has to be a priority. It has to be something that I seek. And this young man is a perfect example of that. How many times are parents in the room? How many times by the deeds of your children have you nearly been ashamed because your child sometimes may have chosen the better part than what you did, or what you were tempted to do at least? So many times, we talked about even last night, right? Jesus pleading with us to become like little children in our desire to follow after the Lord. So this second point we talked about, are we making preparation to journey with the Lord? You know, one of the things that my kids don't always appreciate, but I know that others do, is on a Saturday night, we try not to run ourselves ragged. Saturday night, we try to get home at a decent enough time. We try to get to bed at a decent enough time. Because I promise you that if I wake up Sunday morning like death warmed over, and I'm as grumpy as a grizzly bear, and I'm barking at the kids because I'm not happy and I'm tired, and they're not really that into being polite and pleasant because they're dog tired, mom's dog tired, we're rushing through breakfast, we're barking to get in the van, and we're grumbling all the way to the church building, and put on a smile. What are you teaching your kids? You get in there. This is what we're going to do. This is what we got to do. Or you say, you know what? Saturday night, there's a lot of stuff we want to do, but let's just make sure that we get it kind of planned around so we get home to get some rest because we got church tomorrow. We got the opportunity. We got the privilege to worship God tomorrow, and we need to be prepared for it. You want your kids to learn the scriptures? Your first step in good parenting? Try to provide an environment where they can actually stay awake for an entire service. Just a little bit of preparation goes an awful long way. You know, we parents and adults and grown-ups, you may not have your own children, but you influence young people all the time. Think about some of the simplest ways you can help young people prepare themselves for the Lord. This young man made preparation. Am I being a good enough example as an adult to these young people to make preparations to journey with the Lord? And that's something that's individual. That's something we have to ask. And I hope that you are making preparation. And tonight would be a good time to reflect about what it is that I'm doing. And is there a teaching opportunity there that I could maybe explain to my children or the young people in our congregation or in our community why we're doing what we're doing? You know, we're told to train up children. Training is more than the belt. Training is more than the hand. Training is more than grounding. Training is more than whatever discipline form you choose. Training is teaching. Yes, there comes discipline. Yes, there comes correction. But there needs to come instruction. And we need to make sure that we're taking that opportunity to do that. And then the third point here is this idea, you know, how much are we willing to share? We know by the illustration what the young man shared. How does that compare to what we're often willing to share? I'm curious from the audience, are there any other things that you see in this young man's example that are very noteworthy to look at tonight in the context of such great faith in such young people? Anything come to mind? Any other things that I didn't mention? There's got to be more, but I really don't want to do all the talking tonight if I can help it. Any thoughts out there?
Right. It's probably likely something that he worked for, that he was able to go out, and now the bread he could have carried with him. And again, we don't know exactly how, but they were gone long enough, this is something that he's done recently. Mm-hmm. And so, there's a little bit of work to go along with that foresight in this young man. And again, you don't know how old he is, but if It seems just in him calling him a young lad, the apostles aren't that old.
Right.
They were pretty
That's
young
a good point.
When, so for him to call him a young lad, whether his parents were there or not, whoever he was there with must not have been prepared either, because this is all they have.
Yeah, right. No one else that we have in this record, right? It's not like, okay, everybody, we used to do this. We were out in the field. Different teams get separated, things, you get lost. You throw all your food on the tarp. Stretch that out. Let's every team put your stuff in here and figure out. We got like 52 people here to got to feed. Let's see what food we've got, see how long we can last out here before we have to do something different. Start hunting for food or whatever it is. And then once you know what all that food is there, then you can divvy it up. Okay, this is how much food we have. This is how much we all get. Even Philip said that, right? But even if we had 200 denarii, even if everybody had a little, it still wouldn't be enough. You know, you dig into the history and all the other stuff, and some folks are writing and saying that wouldn't even be enough to feed 2,000 people, what he had mentioned to buy. And here we're talking about just 5,000 people? Is that what it was? 1,000 men. So what's the significance in that, Tony?
Probably at least double.
Because who wasn't often counted in the number? The women and children, right? We talk about when Israel left Egypt, right? Talk about that number and look at how many, those were the men that were counted. But when you think of the whole host, it's amazing.
And again, depending on how old he is, he was 20 and under, he wasn't even counted.
Right. Right. But it's interesting, though, that no one, at least in the record that we have, no one thought to bring anything but this. And I think that looks really good for him. And possibly very poor for all the adults that were present. You know, this is something somewhat interesting, but I think it builds some value into what we're talking about tonight. What does it mean when we say the synoptic gospel? So the gospels, right? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the gospels of our New Testament. There are four different accounts of Jesus' ministry. And they talk a lot about very similar things sometimes. And they're called, there's three of them that are called the synoptic gospels. It's kind of a weird word. We don't use it a lot. But there's a lot of similarity between these three gospels. What are the three synoptic gospels? Somebody tell me those. Anybody? Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Okay. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are the synoptic gospels. They're the ones that seem to tell their stories with the most kind of overlap and supplementary type perspective. You have the gospel of John. Right, and the Gospel of John is a very special gospel. I think it's a lot of people's favorite gospel because there is such a different type of almost really personal, intimate connection with John and Jesus, and that shows itself in the Gospel of John. But you know, do you have any idea in Christ's life, and there's a lot of events in Christ's life recorded in the Bible, of course, in the Gospels. Somebody just throw out a number of how many events in Christ's life do you think are recorded in all four Gospels. Remember, we talked about the synoptic, right? The three that are really, really common. But something that would be shared carte blanche, no matter what, blank check, across all four Gospels, that would tell me that, boy, that's something that's got its own unique specialness to it. Anybody have any idea, out of the events of Christ's life, how many events are shared across all four Gospels? Are you brave enough to throw a number out there? Casey, throw a number out there. 10. Wow, is he close. So he's only one away, folks. 11. And outside the resurrection of Jesus Christ, which I would classify as, of course, a miracle, this is the only miracle wrought by Jesus recorded in all four Gospels. Isn't that interesting? When you think about this amazing event being recorded all the way across. You know, at the end of John, it talks about, right, I suppose that if all the things about Jesus were written, that the world could not contain the books thereof, right, or the books that would be written. There'd be so much that we could write about if we tried to write everything about Jesus. The world couldn't even contain the books, right? But isn't it interesting? I've always put special emphasis whenever the Bible repeats itself. You know, my dad always said, don't make me repeat myself, and we really hoped he never did. But yeah, when the Bible repeats itself, you better pay attention. You better pay attention anyway. But if it's repeating itself, it's kind of like what it says to me is, hey, dummy, I hope you're paying attention real close because I'm repeating this for your benefit. I see that in this idea of this one miracle being shared in all four Gospels.
And it's not only that, not only that God thinks it's important, but because there was some leeway given to these writers. Mm-hmm. They were guided by the Holy Spirit, but it was also, this is something that was important to all four of them. They saw, well, at least the three, and then Luke, it would have been an important enough story mm-hmm. that he was told as he was doing his history.
To make sure it was captured. And go back to this young man. This young man is recorded in all four Gospels. This young man's willingness, his preparation, his priority, his charity is recorded four times. And as we walk through this a little bit, it's going to unfold that we're going to look at a little bit of the emphasis that come because of this ability to teach this. Another kind of thought question. You know, we're just in the verse 5 of John chapter 6 when it says, Jesus lifted up his eyes. And he saw the great multitude, the great company come to him. And he said to Philip, when shall we buy bread that these may eat? You know, usually when a gospel preacher comes to town and he's doing a meeting for you, is he usually trying to find a small hall somewhere so he can cook for everybody? No, what's his expectation? Well, I hope his congregation's got some good cooks. I mean, I have no idea. I'm not, I don't ever call myself a full-time guy. I work with the experiences I have. I've been fed some and I've loved it. But I can tell you that it's a blessing. It's an extra special treat to be invited into someone's home and to share in that offer of love. You know, I've never had anybody throw food at me because they hated me. You know, you commune with someone. You set a meal before them. You share with them. It's a very intimate time with them. It's no surprise that when someone is wayward, it's one of the things they focus on, no, not even to eat with that person. Because it's such a special time. It's such a special connection. But Jesus, he's the teacher, the master teacher. The multitudes are coming to him. He's out in the woods. And he's like, we should probably feed these people. Just one of tons of illustrations of how God provides, even physically, for his people. I want to hear from the audience. Give me some times that God fed his people by no input of their own. Well, let me not say that. Just tell me some times that God fed his people. The manna in the wilderness. Very good. What's another one?
The wedding.
Right. Very good. The miracle of the wedding feast. Right. What else?
It was drink,
but, you know, sustenance kind of thing. Think Old Testament. What are some other times that God fed his people? Bingo. Man, I was wondering if someone was going to pick up on that. The very beginning, folks. The Garden of Eden, right? Now, granted, they had to dress and keep it, but did they have to plant it? It was already there. God was feeding them from the very beginning. What else? There's some other times. Okay, right? Yeah. Oh, man, I didn't write that one down. That's one. I love that story. Yeah, the meat and the water by the brook and everything. Absolutely. What else? Right, the quail, that was along with the manna, so right, providing even more sustenance because they were complaining about getting food for free. Although, I mean, you eat the same thing a long, long time, I suppose you might be inclined to complain a little, I don't know. What else? Right, and he preserved the, I think it's 3,000 that had not bowed the knee. All right, right. That, okay, I was going to say, is that what you're getting toward? Yeah, so Travis brought that up. That's okay, that's good. Anything to do with a guy that had a lot to do with the Old Testament after Moses was laid to rest? You think about that? The Lord told Joshua to go to Jericho. So when they took the promised land, do you remember that God said, you're going to go in and you're going to enjoy fields that have already been planted, wells that have already been dug, vineyards that are already producing, right? So there's another time that he provided. Now, granted, other people would work there, but yet that was God's provisioning for them. How many times in the famines were there grain in Egypt still, right? So that Israel would be preserved. And then, of course, we have two accounts here in the New Testament of people, the multitudes, in a wilderness of sorts, and being fed. Of course, this is the first of the two, the feeding of the 5,000 that we're talking about tonight. So, when you think about God's willingness, God's provision, that should impress us some. That should cause us to think about the idea that God very much cares about our spiritual nature. But he most certainly cares about our physical nature as well. And we're going to talk a little bit about how that kind of applies in a couple other instances. It's a little bonus question, I guess. In this context, when we're talking about loaves and fishes, What was inside the tabernacle in the Old Testament in terms of something to eat? The table of showbread. Anybody have any detail? Like, what did that consist of? Obviously, it was a golden table, right? And it was fashioned with rings and to be carried like poles, similar to the ark. But what had to be present there? Does anybody remember some of that instruction about the showbread? Be made every Sabbath and placed on the table of showbread hot. And that it was to remain there until the next Sabbath, when the priest would make it again in preparation, I should say, for the Sabbath, to then be placed on the table and then those 12 loaves taken and eaten by the priest. He said that had to be there continually as a reminder to Israel that God would always provide for his people. And not just in a spiritual sense. And I thought, well, that's very interesting. When you look at the history of God being a very literal bread, but yet we're going to look at a little bit of a transition here as we go in. So what's being taught by the seaside here? What is Jesus hoping to accomplish? We have a huge multitude here. What are they coming to hear? Well, we are familiar with a great opportunity of teaching in the wilderness, kind of from a high place, and we call that the Sermon on the Mount. Well, this ain't it. This is a multitude of people that are coming to Jesus. Anybody remember why they're coming? Why are these people coming to Jesus? Why is this great multitude coming to see him? It's right here in the beginning of chapter 6. Anybody catch that? What was it? Miracles and signs, right? And specifically it mentions what? Oh, okay, so he brings up the Feast of the Jews. This is kind of a side point, but yet this could be very well why there are so many, right, that are in this area, you know, preparing for that. But yet, what's verse 2 say toward the latter part of that verse? He healed people. Now, I don't know if there's a single one of you in this audience that's perfectly healthy. I know a bunch of you are very healthy. And a lot of you are healthy as I'd like to be as healthy as you are. But I'm also humble enough to know that there are some people in this audience who probably don't enjoy much health at all. But you're here tonight and your faith should be praised. Because amidst those shortcomings and amidst those weaknesses, you've put God first in your life and that should be commended. But wouldn't that be a draw for me if I knew I could go follow after a guy who could possibly heal me? He could fix what's wrong with me in a physical way. Because nobody else could. And how many different times are we touched and are we moved by Jesus having compassion on people with infirmities, some lasting their entire lives, some defining the very nature of who these people were, but because of Jesus' love, it completely heals them. I always go back to Paul when he was on the island of Patmos, right? And the snake came out and he thought he was going to die because he'd escaped, and then they saw that he didn't die, so then he thought he was a god, but yet on that little island, right, I want to say it was Publius, I think. He went to heal the guy's daughter. But then it said before they left, they healed all the manner of sickness on the island and then left. You think about what the early history of the people of that island must have been like when you read about the account of these men coming from a broken ship, proclaiming a God that we didn't know, and leaving not one illness on our island when they left. And what that effect has on people, what that willingness to share of God's power through Jesus had on people. And because of this young man's willingness to share this meal, kind of unfolds another opportunity to Jesus do that very thing again, to share in a way that only he could share for his people. But yet we have a multitude that's gathering, right? And they're gathering because they saw all this. But yet, let's read again a little bit further, not again, but let's read a little further in John chapter 6, if you're still there. And we're going to go down to verse 47, because this kind of sets the stage, right? They saw some people be healed. They're flocking to him at this place. He's now fed all of them. And there's so many details we're not even going to cover tonight for the sake of time, but we see that they've all been fed and they got just a little bit. What's the narrative say in John 6? How were they fed? Until they were what? Full. You know, some days it takes a little more to fill me up than another day. But yet it says with those little loaves and those two fish, everyone ate until they were full. And then, on full bellies, which we know nowadays is kind of a dangerous audience to teach to. Because full bellies means nodding eyes, right? The blood sugar drops. We're trying to stay awake. But yet there are full bellies. And he's getting ready to teach to them. And he says in verse 47, most assuredly I say to you, he who believes in me has everlasting life. I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and are dead. This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I shall give is my flesh, which I shall give for the life of the world. And if you read all the way through 6 and into 7, you know, Jesus has some hard things to talk to these people about. And not a lot of people fully understood what Jesus was trying to say. And later in the discourse, some people said, how can this guy give us his flesh to eat? This is a hard saying. You know, who can hear it? And it says that they didn't follow him anymore. And Jesus turned to his disciples and said, will you also go away? And then a very famous verse we all know, to Lord, whom shall we go? For thou hast the words of life. So we see here, but yet by the feeding of the physical nature, he opens a stage to kind of talk about the spiritual food that God is able to provide. Now, has anybody here went an entire day without eating a meal? Anybody went 2 days without eating a meal? 3 days without eating a meal? 4 days without eating a meal? How many days did Jesus fast in the wilderness? I've never been that far, but I've been 4 days without a meal. And I'm not the same person. And I don't think you would be either. You know, when they taught us what they called wild food procurement, and they said, you know, we're going to teach you how to eat all kind of stuff, because out here, 98% of the forest is edible, but only about 6% of it is palatable. So what that means is there's an awful lot out here that you're going to be able to use to sustain yourself, but you ain't going to like the taste of it. And they talked about crickets and cockroaches and maggots and worms and all these different plants and mosses and stuff. And people are like, no way. There's no way. I'd rather expire than have to eat all that. And that's what everybody talked about, you know, till lunchtime, day one. You know, and then a couple people started getting a little quiet. You know, the end of day one, started some chatter. Well, out of all that stuff they mentioned, what do you think tastes the best? Then day two, everybody can't stand each other because they already got that hangry, grumpy kind of thing going on. And all you had was water. Let me tell you, by the end of day two, there were already people willing to try the assorted fare that the Lord has provided in the wilderness, if you will. And there wasn't no honey around or locusts, right? Or, well, there was locusts. But yet, day three, virtually everyone had already tried to gag down something. And I was trying to hold strong to see how long I could do this, but I can tell you my first experience of it was 4 days. And by that fourth day, I don't think it really mattered. If they put it in front of me, I would eat it. And I can tell you that you would very likely probably do the same thing, because you act differently. You think differently. Sleep deprivation alone, right, changes our behavior. Food deprivation most certainly does. And we know at what lengths we go to have food and to eat food. We know when we've missed a couple meals, that good meal that we have, and it's so filling and it's satisfying. Tony and I share an absolute love of DJ's Ribs in Weirton, West Virginia. And I don't think there's better barbecue ribs out there. And I mean, that's about the only meal I actually eat until I might ache a little bit, because it's that good. But we know what it's like to be satisfied by a meal when we desire it, when we long for it, when we've been nourished by it. But see, Jesus said that he was the kind of bread too. And I really kind of wish our physical bodies would somehow show the amount of spiritual starvation that we sometimes suffer from. Because sadly enough, Jesus does fill all in all. But a lot of times we don't take time to sit down for even a snack. But I can tell you that when we look at how many different times in simple illustrations Jesus shows that I'm going to take care of you if you'll let me. And I'm going to do it in such a way that you got 5 little loaves and 2 smelly fish. And you're going to take up 12 baskets of scraps. You know, it's interesting what he says when he says take up the scraps so that nothing would be lost. Sermon in itself right there. You know, we use the 23rd Psalm at funerals, times of comfort, because it's such a beautiful way to illustrate God's presence with us. And we have all known angst and anger and anxiousness. We've all known that when we feel that way, we don't really have much of an appetite, do we? And we know that we feel that way sometimes when we're around people that don't like us. Right? You ever see a kid like in an environment where people are like being real mean? You know, they just kind of like, they kind of want to just drift into a crack somewhere. Like, because they don't want to be around all that ugliness. We're not much different as adults. Nobody wants to run in and celebrate when people are got their claws and fangs out. But isn't it interesting that in Psalms 23 and verse 5, it says, "Thou prepare a table for me in the presence of mine enemies." If I'm in the presence of my enemies, I probably don't have much of an appetite. But you know, when you're comfortable and you have trust in your safety and you know that someone is looking out for you, those parts of your body that control your appetite and your anxiety and your fear and your endocrine system and all those, or digestive system rather, they kind of return to normal. They stabilize a little bit. So you could enjoy a meal. And that's just a piece of the measure of love they're talking about in Psalms, that even in the presence of your enemies, I'm going to prepare a feast for you. Yet another time we have an illustration of God providing for us. And how interesting is it when he says, "You'll anoint my head with oil and my cup has a splash of drink in it." No. My cup is halfway full, Lord, and I'm a half full kind of guy. No. My cup runs over. That's the kind of provision God has for us. That's the kind of provision we need to walk and run to the wedding banquet, if you will, to feast on. But yet, like this little lad showed, he made it a priority to be there. So many of us are absolutely starving ourselves with absolutely no need. So, Jesus, when shall we buy bread that these may eat? You know, we don't have a ton of record of Jesus poking at the disciples and the apostles, trying to test them a little bit. But he does test them. So I ask you a question. Is it fair? Is it fair that God tests us? What's your thinking on that? Mark, you're nodding your head yes. Why does it seem fair that God would test us? Isn't it? He already knows our heart and mind. I've had these discussions, you can tell. Why does he have to test me just to prove a point? Right? What would your answer be to that? Right.
So I think it just has to do with our flesh grasping what Jesus is capable of doing.
Excellent point. And you saved me some time in the end, because that's in the end, right? They still didn't kind of get it after they showed it a couple of times. Because most certainly by now, you know, these folks would have seen several miracles of Jesus, but yet still defining or still discerning, still looking at things from a very fleshly perspective. But yet, when we're tested, it gives us this opportunity to kind of put our knowledge to work, doesn't it? To have faith in those things that we know. It helps to demonstrate our level of learning, our level of understanding. Helps us confirm the things that we believe that we have faith in. It gives us an opportunity to act and to show and to speak those things that we know. But we have to make sure that we're careful that we don't confuse testing with tempting. Right? Testing is an opportunity to see if you're going to react in a righteous way. Tempting in the Bible context is nearly always in reference to a temptation for wickedness or evil. And James is very clear, right, about telling us that God tempts no one that way. Who tempts us? Who tempts us? We're drawn away by our what? Our own lusts and enticed. Someone over here said the devil or Satan, and he's certainly got his hands full with all that. But yet, we have to be careful when we see testing in our lives that we don't murmur and complain about it. You look at how many different times people were tested in the Scriptures. You look at how many different times that amazing amounts of good and growth and victory came to people in their worst of their lives, in their most serious trials, in the times that they were most sorely tempted, or the times their lights shone the brightest, or the times they learned the most valuable lessons, or the times they saw God's strength in most magnificent form. So we have to be very careful that we don't murmur against those trials when they come. Tony?
This was also, I mean, and again, whether it's, God never really tells us that what he does is fair. You know, it's just, it's righteous. So, you know, whether it's fair or not,
is irrelevant.
This is for them, mm-hmm. too, because he's going to be gone at some point, and they need to figure out where to go. You know, and it's interesting to me that as he's asking this question, it seems that a lot of the disciples had gone out in the crowd, and they're thinking, and he's sitting right there. One of our teachers tested us once when we were young and said, you can use any reference in the room to take this test. And so you know, everybody's whipping out their books, and they're talking to each other, and I just walked up to the desk and said, hey, do you have the answer key with you? She said, I most certainly do. And it's like, you know, he's sitting right there, and they're going to all these other places, and like Mark said, they're thinking very physically, you know, in trying to solve this problem, but he needs them to understand that they can always go to him to solve that. Even when he's gone, they can still go to him to solve those problems.
Excellent point. And how many times have we struggled in our own lives and sought out the guidance, not that it's necessarily a bad thing, but sought out the guidance of human wisdom before we sought the wisdom of the Lord, before we consulted the Scriptures, before we spent time in prayer, before we just unplugged and spent time meditating on the will of God. Excellent point. Now, as we hasten along, because I notice time's getting by me even yet tonight, why is it important for us to know what God can do through can do so much through so little? What's the value in this? Why do we need to know this? You know, we say we don't want to state the obvious. What I've learned in my life is sometimes things aren't so obvious. So what do we take away from this idea that God can do so much with so very little?
Trust him?
Because by doing so much with so little, who's not providing a lot? Right? We're not asked to come with a bounty. We're not asked to come with massive amounts of anything. But look what he is able to do with the least of things. I can tell you that we can show our faith, can't we, in such little things. We can show our obedience. We talked about that, right? Faithful in little versus faithful in much. How much did the widow throw in? That's right. That's right. And we look at that in context and say so little. But in that context, what was it? All that she had. So by comparison, right, that could be a huge amount of money for someone else. But even in that opportunity of her casting in those two mites, look at the teaching that took place. Look at the ripple effect that Christ is able to teach the multitudes, the disciples, the apostles, from just this one account and this young man's sharing his lunch. But a counterpoint to this, right, and we have to be careful of this, is there's something else that can do great things from just a little. And this is the concept that we talked about when he said, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. There's a counterpoint here. Even though that we know that we want to make sure that we're faithful in those little things and we're willing to do those least little things, we also have to be very careful about sin in those measures. But yet, I was reading something somewhere, and I come along this, and I can't find the reference to where it had come from. But when you think about the Old Testament, one of the things that I think of when I think about God doing so much with so little are the battles. And how many times God said, bring all of your fighting men and get in a full fighting array. Bring the whole host. And then he said, okay, you guys can go home, and you can go home, and you can go home. And I mean, I'm out on the front line. I've got this whole host of Israel out there ready to go. And then you're like, you're looking around, and you're maybe half that size. And then, you know, people keep leaving. And next thing you know, you're looking around, and there's like 300 of you, when there might have been 30,000 of you. How brave are you? A little bit different scenario, right? But look at the wisdom in that, folks. Look at the wisdom in God being able to show His strength and His willingness to show you that His will prevail. But it won't be by your strength. It'll be by His. Apostle Paul, right? Thorn in the flesh. Prayed how many times, right? Please take this thing away from me. But he said, my grace is sufficient for you, Paul. But what did he tell him next? For my strength is made perfect. My strength is completed. My strength is most best shown in weakness, in your weakness, in our weakness. And how many different times do we see that our desire to run after and do for ourselves, seek our own bread and not Jesus as the bread of heaven, leaves us empty and shallow, because that's not where God's strength is. God's strength is in our weakness. God's strength is in this opportunity for Him to show that He has power and control. And this idea that He that can make one man chase 1,000. Because virtually, I mean, that there's stories all through the Old Testament of this happening. Can make one loaf feed 1,000. That's the God that we serve. That's something that we need to be impressed with. But yet, you know, then looking back at this lad's example and the things that he gave, What am I willing by example to give? What am I willing to show? And I just ask you this as a simple illustration. Have you ever said, you know, when I get that next paycheck, or I'm sorry, not paycheck, when I get that next raise, right? When I get that different job, when I get a little bit more time, when we get a bigger house, we'll have the get-togethers, or we'll do whatever it is. How many times have we reasoned within ourselves, you know, when I finally get here, I'll do this? We reason like that. It's not necessarily sinful and shameful, but there's a danger there that says that if we're never busy doing what we can do with what we have right now, then we're most certainly very vulnerable, aren't we? You know, this kid could have said, you know what, if I'd have brought more out of shared. But he's not ducking to the weeds trying to hide his basket, right, or his food. He's not trying to keep it for himself. He's only got a little bit. He's got way short of what would really be needed, but he gave it. And are we that kind of person? Are we that person that's still making an excuse? Well, you know, but I'm just not there. I just don't have... Man, God meets you where you are. We know this, right? But he loves you far too much to leave you where he found you. He's told us that you don't have storerooms big enough for the blessings that I can pour out from the windows of heaven. But yeah, we're so miserly sometimes. We got our five loaves and our two fish, and they stink to high heaven because they're hiding in our pocket. We're trying to keep it for ourselves. And if there's one simple illustration I've heard a long time ago, it was simply that you can't outgive God. And how many different times, and I hope that you've done it, because academically understanding it is not just enough. You know how you genuinely know it's better to give than receive? Right? Mentally, we can process that because Jesus said, hey, it's better to give than receive. So a good God-fearing Christian would say, okay, Jesus said it, I believe it. It's better to give than receive, and I believe that. But you know how you genuinely know without a doubt that it's better to give than receive? How do you know that?
It makes you feel good.
Because you did it. You actually went and did it. And you realized when I gave, how good it made me feel. Folks, you can't force people to love. You can't force people to be happy. It's a byproduct. And those people that have the greatest amounts of love and have the greatest amounts of joy is because they're doing the things in this context that God has taught us to do that brings joy and love. Why do we want to follow the example of this little kid? Because he illustrated one of the most fundamental aspects of the gospel of Jesus Christ. He gave. Not only did he give, he gave all that he had. And I've got to venture an assumption here and say that probably made him feel pretty good. And the time will fail us really tonight to talk about all the other implications, right, that this miracle provided Jesus to teach the disciples and the apostles, not to mention the fame that would go abroad about this miracle, so much so that it tempted people the wrong way, right? Because it's not very far along in John. He says, you're following after me, but you're not following after me. You're following after the food. But yet, how many different opportunities do we have in this illustration to see God's provision for us? So lastly, as our time comes to an end, we have these same three questions we're going to kind of ask every night. And they're important because I want these to be a little bit of a takeaway for us. More so, or more than maybe just the thoughts that we have in the class that we've shared. What value here should be taken home for me and my family? What's something tonight that you've considered, that you didn't consider before when you read this account? Anybody have anything they want to share? What's one thing that you look at differently now that you're going to take home tonight that has broadened your understanding, that has pricked your heart, that you didn't contemplate before tonight? Think about that. Anybody? Oh, I thought I saw a hand up.
James.
Yes. That's right.
So they bring water and turn it into wine, the best wine. And in this illustration, in my head, this is how I see it, is the boy had two sardines and they were eating fried perch whenever Jesus stepped up.
Right.
So I envisioned it was better fish, better bread, good bread that he provided.
What they were willing to eat to their full of, right? Real stale stuff and stuff that's a little rank you're not going to fill your belly with, are you? It was a feast for them. But you're right, that's how God meets us where we are, right? He'll take that little. Yes, sir.
I think of Andrew noticed the boy. He noticed it.
Good point.
You know, we kind of overlook children and the value of them. And he noticed that he had something that could be of value.
And that ties in really well with what we talked about last night, right? Have our eyes open for our young people. Sometimes they're able to provide what we can't provide for ourselves. Absolutely.
And
Well, and you look at how many of our young people in the world over just suffer so much loss. And there's a lot of love there that we can share and we can show. Absolutely. Okay, so what roles do parents have in developing this foundation at home? What's something you can do as a parent here to try to teach this principle? Right there, you could talk about God's provision, always being able to provide. You can show that by an example of giving and sharing. What must we encourage our children to explore? Ephesians 4:28, even though it talks about those that steal, steal no more, but rather work, that they might have something to give when they find someone in need. Let's help our children maybe find ways that they can gather things, whether it be things that they can share with their time or even a little bit of allowance money or whatever it is, and help them find opportunities that they can reach out and help other people. And then what do we hold ourselves to as a minimum? Make commitments together as a family. Look over opportunities that you can share in the capacity that we saw tonight to try to make a better influence. Thank you all very much for your time tonight. I'm sorry we didn't have a lot of time for those questions, but Lord willing, we'll see you all again tonight as we close out the week together.